abundant in volume yet scarce, soothing and relaxing yet bearing a devastating force. Defies the laws of physics, and it can heal as much as it can harm. It is the source of life. I'm Idan, and from Israel New Tech and PI Media, this is Waterline.
Welcome back to Waterline. In January of 2019, I was in London to interview Dr. Michael Gilmont. We met in a small studio on a freezing winter day. Dr. Gilmont is a research fellow at the University of Oxford Environmental Change Institute and is a research associate of INSIS. A trained hydrologist and economist, he looks into the politics, economics, and hydrological facts in his analysis of water resource development. Israel is one of the countries he researched and was happy to share his take on the most intricate ingredients that make up the Israeli model: legislation, pricing, and structure. I began by asking, how well does he think the Israeli water system works?
I think Israeli water managers will be the first to admit that things work until they don't work. And the country experienced a series of crises every 10 years from the mid-1980s, punctuated by "It's okay, we can carry on," which is almost a perfect example of what in the literature is known as the hydrological cycle of, rain, everyone's happy, things are going on nicely, there's a drought, there's a panic, we have to do something, we're on the verge of doing something, and then the rains come again, and you resume normal behaviour. That said, I think as much as my own research has looked at, certainly over the last 20, 25 years, there have been a number of substantive changes, both within the triad and within the technical side of the country's water management system. Answering your question, does it work? It is proven to work. Let's see what and when the next crisis is. I think, again, my answer is conditioned by see the depth of the next crisis. There is certainly a high degree of resilience within the system, and I think a lot of intelligence. This probably comes down to those working within the structure rather than the structure itself, and an awareness at critical junctures of the need for proactive change and for recognizing how far change can be pushed at any one time.
Meaning?
Looking at the ongoing debates and tensions over the revision of agricultural water pricing, potentially there is a recognition that things have been pushed too far in this grand scheme of uniform pricing. Meaning the stress on agriculture, certainly in the north, is too much in the current climate. Whether that's an actual fact of reality or that's a fact of political discourse, I don't know, but the fact that there does appear to be a sensitivity that, okay, let's see how this can actually be made to work and how this can be sensitively pursued.
Effectively meaning that the farmer is saying the water now is way too expensive for us.
Water will become way too expensive for them. It's not for me to pass judgment on that, but that is the current state of the political discourse. There appears to be enough intelligence within the water management system and agriculture to come to some kind of sustainable agreement on that. Going back to your question, does the system work? And again, it comes down to, in terms of the triad, it comes down to resilience and adaptability. Again, looking over the last 25, 30 years, there's a very strong structure. There's a very strong commitment through various generations of managers to pursue different targets. But I think there is also a prevalence of pragmatism at key moments. And I think almost the greatest strength of the Israeli model is that political, technical, and economic pragmatism can surface and cool heads can prevail. And I think the general success of the Israeli water story is testament to that. Now, I can't say whether that is by design or by luck or by, serendipity of having the right people in the right place. You could say that is some kind of inherent genetic design, but that's how things seem to be working out.
You started talking about, you said, I'm not going to say if it's true or not.
about the prices that farmers are supposed to pay.
Mm.
Waterline is quite honest about promoting the idea of you should pay for water.
Yeah.
You should pay for what you consume.
Yeah.
But I'm going to question this. Should you pay?
Well, I mean, at a fundamental domestic level, there's this argument of sort of water as a human right. And mm-hmm. why should you pay for something which is so fundamental to your existence as a physical living being?
Well, I think, what are you paying for when you're paying for water? You're paying for a service delivery. You're paying for the treatment of that water. You're paying for the conveyance of that water, the energy used to pump and pressurize that water, the energy used to treat that water and allow it to be reused within the domestic sector, within the agricultural sector, in order to not pollute the environment. And therefore provide a sustainable environmental base for both human and natural life. So it's almost that you are paying for the cost of provision and for the use and impact of your use of that water. Your question is, should we be paying for that? And which comes down to sort of deeper questions, I guess, about, you know, what should be paid for by the individual and what should be provided by the state. That is difficult to answer. I mean, you could say that, well, even state provision, if someone has to pay for that energy, if the state provides it, that will come through state revenues and through tax. So then you get into questions of, okay, a state could provide water resources and then could be backed up by a very progressive taxation system. Okay, fine, or a non-progressive taxation system. Somebody has to pay for the conveyance and treatment of that water.
When you're talking about someone has to pay, usually it means subsidies. Even in a state like Israel, that we've been paying for water, you know, since day one of the state. What about places where people don't pay for water at all? In one of the previous episodes, we talked about the fact that politicians should be brave.
Yes, politicians should be brave. Politicians should also be pragmatic.
Because it's not a popular thing to put a levy on water.
It is not. The fundamental question is not so much what instrument is used, but what is the outcome that you're trying to get from that instrument. And yes, yeah, basic economic principles and the use of price plus other instruments has been shown to work. If pursuing that policy would result in a level of social and political risk which is unpalatable, undesirable, or intolerable, then maybe it isn't the right instrument for that time. Maybe it can be an aspiration, but it might be foolhardy to rush headlong into a program of pricing if society and the political economy cannot tolerate it. Or indeed, if it could tolerate it, if, you know, yes, there'll be acceptance of the principle, but it'll just be flouted to the extent that it's not worth pursuing. So I think more fundamental questions on the relationship between state and society and the sort of social contract of the state and the extent to which potentially there are more fundamental changes and strengthenings required before water pricing could be either effective or tolerated. So again, you know, you go back to the Israeli case. Yeah, you say you've been paying for water from day one, yes, but there's also been a very strong relationship between state and society from day one. Society sort of gave birth to the state, and the state has moulded society in a way that's probably very rare for a modern country to have grown up in such a short space of time. So, yeah, pricing works in the right political economy context, and I think the questions need to be asked is, does the instrument fit the context, or does some more work need to be required on the context before the instrument can be put into place?
So if we are trying to suggest this path from the Israeli model to other places in the world?
I think the most valuable part of the Israeli model is the balance of policy, economic, and technical instruments pursued at the right time, by design or by luck, and with a great deal of sensitivity, again, by design or by luck, and a willingness to be flexible
and to adapt and to acknowledge or to have voices prevail who say that, okay, yes, this is a good idea. Desalination is a good idea. Maybe not immediately, for better or worse, in terms of continued overdraft and deficit. How can we think intelligently about rolling this out? How can we go at a pace at which people are comfortable? How can we bring other people with us? How can this discussion between ministries of finance, ministries of agriculture happen and evolve to bring kind of a sustainable pathway of policy? And for me, the creation of that space of political dialogue within a sector is actually the most important lesson that the Israeli water sector can provide to the world. Or it's as important, let's say, as the kind of more technical instruments that it's used.
So we kind of talked about the pricing. Let's turn this triad clockwise, mm-hmm. and now we have in front of us the structure. Now, when we're talking about structure, is both the physical one and something which is derived from legislation. But we won't talk about legislation just now. Let's talk about the structure, both the physical and the institutional. It seems to be working okay, although, as we heard in the previous episode, there's something about the responsiveness of this sector in the span of the 70 years to find the right solutions for the times. Let's start with 1959 and go from there. There are two major changes done. If the starting point is 1959,
mobilization of water through the completion of the National Water Carrier.
And then we get to the year 2000, and then we have another one in the late 2000s.
I think there's another point in the middle, which is the 1980s and the adoption of policies to significantly reuse wastewater in agriculture. That, combined with desalination, obviously two large new supply increments, which I think historically, let's say, had that policy somehow by warping of space-time and technological know-how been implemented 30, 40, 50 years ago, that would have been used on top of the natural resource endowment. And the trick, or the very astute policy that has been pursued, again, design and necessity, has been to use treated wastewater plus desalination as a means of not only growing the national volumetric capacity, but also allowing less dependence on the natural water endowment. So effectively putting water back into the environment by default of not taking it out.
Effectively creating a bigger pie.
Creating a bigger pie, but completely changing the balance of the ingredients and using fewer of your original ingredients. But going back to your original comment, so I think actually another point to make within the context of management is the scale at which Israel has operated. What I mean by this is the both volumes of water that Israel had at its disposal, has been required to manage, and also the spatial scale at which that is taking place.
You didn't really like me asking you this about pricing, if it can work on its own, if we take just the pricing and try to implement it somewhere else in the world. What about the structure part out of the triad? Can it work somewhere else in the world on its own?
In the abstract, probably yes. But again, my argument on sort of pricing came back to political context and state-society relationships. And in terms of the structure, then the political economy of government and governance of natural resources. I think political context is important. I would say not can this structure work in other places in the world, but how can the lessons of the structure, what elements of the structure, what inspiration from the structure could be used to inform a politically and economically appropriate model for other contexts. So again, this comes back to something that Israel itself has demonstrated, resilience and adaptability and responsiveness to new and emergent management challenges. So I think it's the structure and the recognition of responsiveness. So this, in this case, Israel's responsiveness is over time. If you want to apply the structure elsewhere, the responsiveness needs to be in the context. And I think then that comes to a deeper lesson that Israel and other successful water management cases around the world could teach, which is how to be responsive, how to adapt what you have had to meet changing demands and changing contexts. And I think that is really underplayed by those who try and identify what lessons can be learned. That responsiveness, that political and policy and management adaptation somehow gets lost with the promotion of this is our model, this is the structure, this is what you should be doing. I think it's almost that the process is as important as the end point. My key message really is that issue of resilience and adaptiveness over time, and how that same philosophy can be applied for lessons and exemplification elsewhere in the world, taking into account the political uniqueness in many cases of other contexts, and the need to, I think, work with political contexts for managing water rather than working against them.
After the break, we will hear about some trust issues we all have, quite unknowingly, with infrastructure systems. WaterTech Israel 2019, the ideal meeting place for manufacturers, researchers, investors, academics, purchasers, and decision makers representing international businesses. WaterTech 2019 will mark an exciting departure from previous conventions. This year, a first-of-a-kind interactive display area will be introduced to showcase the latest developments and technologies such as digital water, turnkey solutions, and Industry 4.0, to name but a few. Come and meet investors, technology providers, and market representatives, and find out for yourself how to become part of a new ecosystem through unique roundtable discussions, workshops, and brainstorming sessions in a place where water transformation occurs every single day. WaterTech Israel 2019, November 18th through 21st in Tel Aviv. To register, log on to watertech-israel.com or follow the link on Waterline's webpage. Wish to learn more about Israeli technologies and the Israeli water sector? The people of Israel NewTech will be glad to answer your questions. Log on to israelnewtech.com. And don't forget to follow Waterline on Facebook to get updates and give us your feedback. You can also follow me on Twitter at IdanC79. And now, back to the episode. Back to the special interview with Dr. Michael Gilmont.
We're taking the triad, and we're taking it clockwise once more for the last time now. We got to the legislative part of our conversation, which is usually the most... I don't think it's boring, but usually people really run away from it because it sounds heavy. Now, there's something about the Israeli law that is quite different to the rest of the world. As you said, I like the way you phrased it, that the state of Israel was created from...
The state of Israel was born out of a society who founded it, but has then gone on to shape that society.
And one of the strongest ethos we had in Israel, Israel was and still largely is, to some parts of it, a very socialistic in nature. And water in Israel is owned by the public.
Yes.
As I mentioned in one of previous episodes, an Israeli owns the water only in the space between the end of his tap and the intake of the sewage in his sink.
Or to be more precise, he owns the right to use that water. Because, of course, in theory, I believe, unless the law has changed, it is technically illegal to wash your dishes and then capture that water and use it to flush your toilet, or to certainly to capture rainwater, which is a slightly different context. But
you're not mistaken.
So you have the right to use that water.
So I have the right to use the water in only 15 centimeters span. That's, for some people, it's weird. It's unheard of. I mean, if I own the land, I own whatever above it and underneath it. And in this context, it's changing not only the law or the way in which you enforce it, it's a discussion on a completely different level. So we might call this legislation, but this is something that is far deeper.
Yeah. No, I think what is incredible, I think it's incredible both in potential and the degree to which it obviously isn't actualized. The potential is that the 1959 water law and subsequent amendments place the ownership of water and the allocation of water in the hands of the state or the state's nominated representative. Yes, if you own land, you have no right to that water. So in theory, you don't have right to harvest the water that falls on your roof. What this means is that, again, in theory, the state has absolute jurisdiction over where the water goes. If it wanted, all of the water could be allocated to grow
bananas.
And, you know, the population would have to buy bottles of Evian imported from France. Obviously, that's not going to happen. The converse side is that, in theory, if the state wanted, they could eliminate agriculture and say all of this water is going to be used to allow urban growth, to allow everyone, if they've got enough land, to have a swimming pool. Obviously, that's not going to happen, but the potential is there for that to happen. I think what's amazing is that there is a relatively stable middle ground in terms of allocation from one year to the next, allowing for environmental variation. And I think what this says in sort of more challenging contexts where there are very complex ownership structures related to land and water, an example of the complexity of water ownership and diversity of water use rights, shall we say, and the ownership of water use rights. So the Western United States, California, a huge complexity of first in right, first in line. So your right to use water, depending on when you first develop that resource, the right of water connected with land ownership.
Obviously, it's now part of the discourse.
Yeah.
It's been so for the past at least 2.5 decades, 3 decades that people are talking about it.
Hmm.
Do you see this as a preparation for some change?
I think there is an argument that change could be helpful. Again, if you look at the political feasibility and reality and pragmatism of doing something about it, what other options are there to achieve similar outcomes through less contentious means? And I think that is probably the most sensible path. But coming back to the Israeli case, I think what is demonstrated is that even when you have absolute control of water vested in the state, that does not mean that the state is necessarily going to do bad things for you as a historic user of that water. You know, in the 60 years since the water law was passed, yes, agriculture has received proportionately less water, but there is still a strong agricultural sector in the country.
But one might say that the stress brought on this sector made them become more efficient.
Yes, and sort of innovation out of necessity. I think it was a co-evolution of necessity and the inherent drive to innovate. But it's a balance. It's a balance of stress as a driver for innovation and stress. It's just as you can stress a plant through drip irrigation such that it produces a more multiplicitous crop, and you can stress it such that it dies. And it's about finding that balance. And I think, again, yes, I'm sure that there have been moments when that line might have been crossed. And looking at the current pricing reforms, I think that's very, very contentious at the moment. But taking the long view on Israeli water history and allocation, generally that balance has been struck, and there does appear to have been a sensitivity. You know, you think things can be pushed in what, in hindsight, appears to be a healthy direction. But yeah, it's proven to be sustainable.
So we're talking here about this flexibility again.
Again, just flexibility, as with structure. But I think also flexibility and trust in that flexibility. Again, in the theoretical absolute control of water by the state, in as mandated by the water law, appears for the most part not to have been abused in the 60 years in which it's been extant. So I think that teaches a very powerful lesson about what can happen in the right contexts with cool heads.
Reality is that Israel is a small country, and such legislation can only be effective in a small place. I don't see India, with its 1.3 billion people, 29 states and 7 more unities of part of the greater India, being able to work with such a law.
You are probably right. The answer there would be clearly something different. I do not have it for you.
But if you're taking the notion of publicly owned water, is that something that can work in any legislative environment?
This is another case of the context of the relationship between the state and the government and the people. Part of the challenge of much larger countries is that there is that greater distance between a farmer using the water and the legislator in either the state or national government making those laws. And therefore, because of that distance, there's therefore potentially less trust by the farmer and potentially less engagement and awareness by the legislator.
Believe it or not, we've managed to go through the three nodes of the triad. We've come full circle. And there's something that was in the air and something that you kind of alluded to. Trust. Can this triad work without trust?
I think trust is important within the triad, within life, within politics, and I think within the Middle East region as a whole. Trust is a very profound and crucial concept. I think it would be very difficult for it to work without trust. I don't necessarily say kind of overt, explicit trust, because that can kind of come and go depending on individuals involved. But I think a trust that the system generally works and has a history of working. Sorry, just backtracking a minute. I think trust is very profound. If I'm a householder, waking up in the morning, turning on my tap to wash, to have a cup of tea, I want to trust that there is water there. I do invariably trust that there's water there. And on the very few occasions as a Londoner, when I turn my tap on and find there isn't water, normally because I haven't read the note saying they're interrupting supply, it's a bit of a shock. But trust is a basic premise for taking something for granted. If I'm a farmer, I think more significantly, I need to trust that I'm going to be getting water, assume within the bounds of hydrological normality and infrastructural resilience. I need to trust that I'm getting water, both for my year-to-year investments and my long-term investments. And I think if that trust is eroded, there becomes a lot less latitude for the agricultural community to be willing to invest, to adapt. If there's a feeling that this investment is just going to be sliced further in future years, then what's the incentive for me to kind of keep adapting and keep building that resilience? So I think that is absolutely crucial.
But it seems to me, from what you're, the way in which you see this triad within the model, is that it is malleable enough and adaptive enough and elastic enough to withstand even the stressors that it created.
Correct. As with all these things, I think a system, a relationship, be it political or economic, is resilient up until the point that it isn't. And the problem with all these things is you can't prove something until it has happened. That's the challenge of climate change, is that we won't actually know the impacts of climate change potentially until they've happened, and therefore an absolute watertight case for mitigation can't be made until you have the end point, at which case it's too late to mitigate.
So if I'll ask in one sentence, What do you make of the triad within the Israeli model of legislation, pricing, and structure? Is it wrong to try to create this triad? Is it too simplistic?
Yeah, I think it is a little too simplistic in that within legislation, pricing, and structure, you are potentially either missing or underplaying the role of politics, both formal politics within the legislative process, politics between sectors, the relationship between society and government and regulators. And I think the triad is maybe better visualized as a sort of the edge of a spider's web of political mesh that spans that landscape.
If you say it's part of a spider's web, politics are politics, but players are different everywhere. Mm. So you cannot make a rule about it, right? But as you said, in the spider's web, if you aim for this, let's say, area,
yeah,
then you're doing the right thing.
Yeah. And I think there is a need to look and consider politics. Quite often when we say politics, it's, I don't want to say a dirty word, but it is put forward as something that gets in the way, something that is an obstacle to achieving what theory tells us we should be able to. And a lot of my work, my research and my analytical work, is based on this idea that politics is the process by which things happen, and the triad is only what it is by those political relationships, by the political navigations that need to take place between those nodes to generate outcomes that, for the most part, in the Israeli case, have proven very resilient and adaptable.
Dr. Michael Gilmont, thank you very much.
Thank you, it's been a pleasure.
Waterline was brought to you by Israel New Tech and is a PI Media production.